Okay, good. All right. Well, first of all, Happy New Year, everybody. And let's remind ourselves that this is, in fact, a new year. This is not last year with a new name. We already did that year. We don't need to do it again. So Happy New Year. We're looking forward to exciting things that we're going to make happen in 2018. The first thing I want to let everybody know is the June conference in Washington, D.C. is open for registration. So you could, when this meeting's done today, you could actually register for the June conference. And if you were there last year, you know, we're kind of pushing the levels of what the Omni can do anymore. This is the last time we're going to be able to have the June conference in the Omni. So if you're coming, please feel free to go ahead and register today. What's going to happen is in just a moment, I'm going to introduce our guest speaker who we're really excited about. After our speaker's comments, and hopefully there'll be time for a little bit of Q&A, I'm going to go over some of the things that happened last year, including what happened during the year-end appeal. Then we'll talk about what we're doing and get into action. Also, if you're from a new chapter, welcome. It's so great to have you here. Thank you for making yourself part of the really extraordinary group of people. So our speaker today is Dr. Sabina Marks. She's a social scientist based in New York City. She currently serves as project director, risk communication at the National Center for Disaster Preparedness, the Earth Institute, Columbia University. Her expertise falls broadly within the area of decision making under uncertainty, with a focus on risk perceptions, behavior change, and communication of scientific information. She applies social science insights to real-world problems such as climate change impacts on public health, agriculture, food security, water management, energy conservation, and disaster preparedness. A common thread throughout all of her projects is to improve communication of complex scientific and technical knowledge by tailoring information to stakeholder and community needs. I'm going to say something about the people that you're talking to, Dr. Marks, and then I'll turn it over to you in a minute. But I just wanted to tell everybody also that Dr. Marks is starting what we hope will be an ongoing program now, is that in addition to today, she's made herself available for the CCL community on January 25th. So she's going to make herself available for another 30 minutes of question and answer. We're really, really excited about that so that we can get more of her time. One thing you'll see, Dr. Marks, is that none of these people are listening to this as kind of an academic exercise. These people will get into more action with what you offer than I think anybody you're ever going to talk to. So, for instance, when we report the results, what that happened last year, the people you talked to published over 3,500 letters to the editor. So I'm going to go over a series of outputs, but you see they're people who are very much about getting in action. But there's one other thing I want to say about them before I turn it over to you. In 1938, the German author Thomas Mann, the gentleman who wrote Buddenbrooks, and Death in Venice, gave a series of lectures called The Coming Victory of Democracy. And one of the things he said in those lectures was, democracy is the only system built on respect for the infinite dignity of each individual man and woman, on each person's moral striving for freedom, justice, and truth. And then he says, I really think a really beautiful line. It would be a great error to think of and teach democracy as a procedural or political system, or as the principles of majority rule. He said, democracy is the only system built on respect for the infinite dignity of each individual man and woman, on each person's moral striving for freedom, justice, and truth. It would be a great error to think of and teach democracy as a procedural or political system, or as a principle of majority rule. The reason I wanted to read that to you, Dr. Marks, is because the people you're talking to actually take the view that they are the stewards of our democracy. That's not something happening over there, but there's something that they're responsible for making sure that democracy works the way that it actually should work. It's a really remarkable group of people. And thank you. We're so excited to have you. Welcome. Great to have you on the call. And I think Ricky will probably be forwarding your slides this morning. Welcome.
Okay. Thank you so much, Mark, for this introduction and for sharing these fantastic words by Thomas Mann. It's always great to hear some of the great German writers. And I agree, we do have a great responsibility in keeping the democracy that we have going and improving it. It will never be done. And And thanks for sharing more information about the audience. One key principle of communication is know your audience. And I got a brief glimpse of the kind of audience that that is listening in today when I participated in the Congressional Education Day in November. But I'm fairly new to CCL. I only joined in October. And so I want to learn as much from the audience as they hope to learn from me. So, if we go to the slides, yes, thank you, Ricky. I will be sharing with you today insights from about 30 to 40 years of research in the decision sciences that includes psychology, behavioral economics, anthropology, and others. And the work that we have then done in applying some of the concepts from these sciences at the Center for Research on Environmental Decisions, where I worked for 12 years at Columbia University. I will start with a brief background on risk communication and then give you a few selected examples of barriers to information processing and decision making. And I'll do that so that to help everybody understand some of the psychological barriers to taking action on climate change that we encounter all the time, but understanding the psychology behind it will help us be more understanding of our counterparts, and maybe we will also discover some of these barriers in ourselves. I'll then move quickly to some of the principles that may help overcome some of these common barriers, and then we can take it into some discussion during the Q&A. Okay. So, information is often not used the way it was intended, and we see this all the time. People don't heed warnings to terrible effects, terrible consequences that we see in hurricanes, other extreme weather events, wildfires, and of course, most recently, the debris flow and the mudslides following wildfires very often. So, why is it that people don't tend to the information if the information is available? Well, it is because risk perception is subjective. My perception, I may be afraid of very different things than my neighbor, and I will pay different level of attention to the respective information that is available. And so risk perception is subjective, and this influences the uptake of information and the way I act on the information. This is very crucial to keep in mind, knowing that the person you're talking to may not perceive climate change, for instance, as the same risk as you do. Not because they don't have the knowledge or the cognitive capacity, there are psychological reasons for that. So here are some of the barriers that get in the way of the best intended communications, even if all the information seems to be available to everybody. If you can go back to the previous slides, for this overview. People are selective when attending to information. We very often do something like we're looking for information that confirms our beliefs. That's kind of like a confirmation bias. We also evaluate any information and options by using both cognitive and affective processes. And by affective, I mean, this can be just a hint or a whisper of an emotion. It doesn't have to be a strong emotional panic response. It can just be a hint or a gut feeling. We're also influenced by our beliefs, values, goals, and prior experience with the issue of climate or extreme weather events. We're influenced by the context of the decision and the context during which we receive the information, whether we're alone receiving this information or in a group. And another barrier very often is like people lack the awareness of or access to solutions that are within their capacity and within their authority of decision making. Next slide, please. Thank you. So, the selected barriers to information processing and good decision making that I want to cover are cognitive and affective processes, the role of context, and that's like in this case, the uncertainty of what will others do, which will influence whether I will act from self-interest or from a collective interest position. And then I'll go into the lack or availability of solutions. So next slide, please. Here we see an example of, what makes you jump? You know, we have two processing systems by which we process information. And there's this rational system that scientists very often apply, and they look at charts and curves of CO2 emissions, and they're rising. But that doesn't wake you up or wake up your neighbor who doesn't deal with those kind of with those type of information. So the question is, what makes you jump? And it is clear that the typical abstract and statistical presentations of climate change do not necessarily elicit feelings of fear and concern. But we do require a certain level of affect, emotion, or a vivid response in order to take action. So this, like, even the slightest emotional reaction is a wellspring for action. And that's something that we want to be mindful of, that is required in order for people to pay attention and take action and follow up. And but I also want to warn, we don't want to overdo that. And I'll say more about that. One way to achieve greater emotional response and engagement is by using frames. And next slide, please. One way to frame climate change, you can frame climate change as potential losses or as potential gains. So urging people to engage in some protective activity, for instance, wearing seatbelts, investing in energy-saving appliances, you can describe these options either in form of the advantages of participating in the activity or the corresponding disadvantages of not participating. And when people in studies are presented with these two different options, commonly people are more likely to engage in an activity when the disadvantages of not engaging, so the potential losses due to inaction, are emphasized rather than the advantages of engaging. And next slide, please. So when choices and outcomes, and this extends, previous slide. One more back. Okay, thank you. So when choices and outcomes or policies are framed in terms of potential losses, people usually are willing to invest more time, money, effort, they go the extra mile, or take bigger risks to avoid these losses. When choices and outcomes are presented in terms of potential gains, people tend to select choices that require less effort, going with sure bets. And that is because losses loom larger. We are loss averse. And this is not to say that people don't respond to gains. I mean, we are incentivized by gains. But more people respond more strongly to losses. And so one takeaway is losses loom larger, we are loss averse. So if you think you're immune to such framing, I want to demonstrate the power of framing. Imagine ground meat. And sorry, vegetarians, if you're faced with the two choices of ground meat, which one would you choose in a society where lean is more important? These two are exactly the same ground meat, by the way. Now, another example is money. Next slide, Ricky. Yes. So here's an example of, just imagine I identified an amazing donor who is so excited about volunteers spending an hour of their time on a Saturday listening to a social scientist talk, and you will receive $100 for all your efforts on behalf of CCL. Now, that sounds pretty good. I bet everybody would be pretty happy. Then imagine I told you CCL can no longer run these webinars for free and has to charge for this training. Before you can log off, you have to provide your credit card number and will have to pay $100, otherwise your computer will be locked forever. How do you feel now? Now, chances are we feel different about losing the money than getting the money. In fact, the strength of emotion when we lose $100 is much greater compared to gaining something of equal monetary value. So again, losses loom larger, and in studies we found losses loom almost twice as high as the equivalent gain. Now, another aspect or another barrier to good decision-making and information processing is that we don't necessarily know what others do. So why is it that we don't want to do the things that are in the best interest of society and ultimately for ourselves? It is the interpersonal uncertainty, the question of what will others do in this situation. And we have seen this many, many times in the negotiations that eventually led to the Paris Agreement. But like always, like, the U.S. wonders what will India do? India wonders what will China do? And China says, well, if the U.S. doesn't participate, then we won't participate. So this is where the role of context, in particular the social context, comes in. If we are in a group setting, just by being two people together, two or more, it motivates a concern for others. It puts us in a different state of mind. It's almost like priming us to care for others. It activates social goals and expectations about others' goals and strategies that you don't see when people act in solitude and by themselves. We expect others to conform with social norms. And in fact, receiving information in a group alters the way in which people acquire, learn, engage with, and act on new information. And all this will then determine whether people act from self-interest versus collective interest. Now, what does that mean for CCL? For instance, the Congressional Education Day. And I've only experienced one of those, but we walk in with a group of 3, 4, 5, 6 CCL members, and we are facing one individual, a staffer, a representative, or a senator. And does that create a situation of us versus them? Or might it actually help to have them meet also with a few others that they then commit to each other, okay, we're now in this together. Another way that I saw that would be an argument to, or a way to look at we're creating an us versus them. But I've also seen a way that CCL overcomes this by offering the appreciation. We have usually one person from the district that we're meeting with there that creates an us. And so we're looping the staff or the representative in within our group. And that creates a group setting, which will then motivate maybe more of an engagement and a willingness to act with us and on behalf of our proposal. So I think CCL, with its emphasis on relationships, goes a very long way here. And I encourage CCL to continue to do that. And we can talk a little more about that if people have experienced problems surrounding the issue of us versus them. Now, next slide, please. Some problems are perceived as too big to solve, and climate change is one of them. It's very often viewed as something that's paralyzing. There's nothing we can do about it. And if we feel overwhelmed by a problem, we don't want to think about it. But knowing that there are ways to tackle a problem makes us more likely to accept the existence of the problem. And that's why in our studies, we found that pairing impacts of climate change with solutions is extremely beneficial. And CCL goes even a step further and leading with solutions. I mean, the carbon fee and dividend is a solution, and that's the laser focus, and that's in the foreground. And I think the advantages of that is instilling a sense of efficacy can be really empowering. It can help people reorient toward action and opportunity. It gives people a sense of personal and collective efficacy, and that makes them more willing to look for more information. Being part of a solution can lead to greater overall support of a cause and collective actions. And also, we should not neglect the fact that many solutions have co-benefits. Acting on climate has benefits for health, national security, community building, etc. So leading with solutions is a really important thing. And besides the focus on a solution, the carbon fee and dividend, the value of optimism that CCL highlights fits this bill as well. Now, there is one issue when speaking of the laser focus, and some of the work that we have done, I would say, almost like pose a word of caution about the laser focus. While the CFD is really a powerful policy proposal, we are all aware, I assume, that a whole portfolio of mitigation and adaptation strategies is required to solve the complex problem of climate change. And very often, if we fall into this, what we call a single action bias, we have one activity that will alleviate our sense of being at risk, we very often fall into a rebound effect on other actions. So while many people have replaced their light bulbs with CFLs, they plaster air conditioning or run their heat in the winter or leave their lights on in many rooms simultaneously without being in all of those rooms simultaneously. So I want to make us aware of this bias and look in ourselves. While we are all very active on behalf of CCL, there are many other actions that we also need to take and hopefully do take at home. But we also want to be mindful of other groups who have other proposals that are equally important and need to work in combination, that we help them succeed as well, and that we don't get so single focused. So just something to be aware of. So one last phenomenon before I conclude with some key communication principles is another one of these pitfalls of our minds. We and our audience member have a so-called finite pool of worry. And that's like literally, we can only worry about so many things at any given time. And if we are too alarmist, people will just replace one worry with another, and that can backfire. So being aware of this when talking to members of Congress or your neighbor whom you want to recruit as a new volunteer is really important. And trying to find out what are their priorities. Can we link climate change to that? Is this person afraid of losing their job? Is this person afraid of the next terrorist attack? Chances are we can link climate change issues to that priority. And we also don't want them to drop other important issues. And especially when we go into these congressional meetings, the staffer that we're meeting with or the representative or a senator, they just met with someone else with an important issue. And we were going into one office and Planned Parenthood had just left and we don't want to, and then after us, who knows who comes in. And we also know the time when we were there, the new tax law was on everybody's mind. And so if we can be aware that they have a lot on their plate, and if we can connect the dots of all these things that seem to exist in a silo, if we can connect those dots for them, then there is a chance that all these issues may actually be able to stay in their mind simultaneously. So that's something to think about as well, so that we don't act in our own silo too much. So next slide. Okay. So I would like to conclude with some key communication principles. And I want to comment that CCL is doing so much already and doing so many things really, really well. But I think a really important reminder is know your audience. And that is something, you know, it's the most common communication principle, but it's also the most commonly neglected one. So is your message relatable? Like, what is your audience member's most pressing priority? Can you relate? Can you link your information to them? Does the information, the message grab attention? Like, and you want to strike a balance of being vivid enough, but not too alarmist, and framing the information to elicit sufficient level of an affective response. And that requires that you know your audience a little bit. And going to meetings with the same representatives or building these relationships is so important there. Does your message motivate action? Yes, lead with solutions, translate solutions into actionable steps that are appropriate for your audience, and emphasize the impact of taking action. And lastly, does the information and the proposal foster collaboration, cooperation, and community building? And tapping into the sense of group affiliation, what do we have in common? People are much more likely to follow up if they feel a connection, an affiliation with you, even if it's just a shared symbol, being from the same district or liking the same music or being a fan of the same sports team. It creates this subtle connection based on which that will carry over into their next step. Next slide, please. So this and much more is also available in two publications, and I think they were sent around, the links to them were sent around with the announcement. If not, I'm sure we can get them to you. These are two communication guides that we have worked on at the Center for Research on Environmental Decisions, and the second guide together with Eco America, which is a group that I know is also known and working with CCL at this time. So I'll end with this, and happy to go into some discussion and answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Marks. You did address this, but I want to know if you could elaborate a little bit. Several people sent in the question to me is how you communicate a sense of urgency, but you already said, you know, you can't be too alarmist, right? Mm-hmm. So what is that? Do you have any more advice on the balance of, yeah.
Yes. So, and that's interesting. So the question of urgency, again, I think that goes back to the subjectivity of the risk perception. We think this is urgent. We need to act. And another person does not think of it as urgent. And climate change has, over the last several years, been portrayed as something that is happening in the distant future. It's happening to people far away from me. And it may only be happening to plants and animals and nature and not necessarily to people. So I think it is key to bring the impacts really close to home. And highlighting impacts that we now really that we can attribute to climate change, and science is getting better and better at really attributing, looking at attribution in extreme weather events and climate change. So, looking at local impacts, looking at recent events that may still be pretty present in people's minds, and I think stories are really, really powerful. And very often at least in among the scientific community, we're hesitant to use stories because that sounds like, well, we're watering things down and it's not very scientific. But there's great power in stories and using, for instance, images of people and faces rather than images of animals and nature. So that's one way to show the urgency. But again, yes, we don't want this to backfire, becoming too alarmist, because if we use these emotional appeals too often, it can lead to numbing, and then you're losing your audience's attention again. So keeping the information fresh, and I think we have plenty of local extreme events that we can cite that happen locally or within the same country, and imagery that we can use. So keeping that information and reinterpreting that information according to the priorities of that particular person so that they can really like catch on to something. I think when talking to parents, highlighting the impact on children is an important one. When talking to politicians, I think the issue of national security will bring the issue much closer. So I think there is there's a large toolbox from which to pick and choose, but I want to point out again, like it really, there's no one size fits all. So knowing as much as possible about your counterpart and relating with them first, they're much more likely to listen to you. And if you are not the right messenger for them, maybe you have to let someone else be the messenger and identifying who do they trust. We found that, you know, a lot of people trust their physicians, they trust their a faith-based leader, and maybe we need to leave it up to someone else to talk to some people rather than us trying to convince people with whom we have worked for so long and we're just not getting anywhere. So I think these are just some of the, but I think psychologically speaking, it is very hard for us to wrap our minds around something that will happen in the future. And maybe instead of talking about if and when the next event happens, talking about how can you prepare now, an action you can take now that you can now commit to. That way you're shifting the time horizon from the future to now, and that immediately creates a sense of urgency.
Great. So as I mentioned before, Dr. Mark started speaking, she has graciously offered to do an extended 30-minute Q&A on the 25th of January. That'll be on CCL University on this exact same line. It'll be at 8 o'clock East Coast time, 5 o'clock West Coast time. I don't know if you can see the chat, Dr. Marks, but there's a lot of additional things people want to talk to you about and ask and make comment on. So thank you so much for that. If you can stay on for the next few minutes, I think you'll be excited to hear some of the things that people produced last month. But that was fantastic. And I'll look forward to the session on the 25th also. That was phenomenal. Thank you so much.
And thank you for offering that additional session, because I realize I probably spoke a little longer than we had planned. And so I look forward to the opportunity. And I assume these chat questions, I hope they're saved. And I'll review them and hope to address as many of them as possible on the 25th.
Great. Thank you so much. Fantastic to have you.
Thank you.
All right, good. So I wanted to go over a few things that happened last year, including just the end of the year. So I'll start with the year-end appeal. I think that many of you know we started our year-end appeal on Giving Tuesday, and it ended on December 31st. We had 60 people, 30 men and 30 women, create a matching pool of $600,000. That's a way bigger matching pool than anything we've ever had. I went to our development director, Lene Pettengill, multiple times during the fall and into December and saying, that's a really big number, Lene. What's your plan for hitting it? And she said to me the exact same line every time. She said, Mark, our people will come through. They always do. She said, Mark, our people will come through. They always do. So how did we do towards the matching grant of $600,000? Well, what you actually raised was $870,158. And for an organization this size, it goes a long way towards us being able to put on the conference and put on the lobby, the education day in November, and host events like this. So thank you all for everybody who was able to contribute financially, everybody who cheered people on. That's a huge win for the organization, and it really sets us solidly into 2018. Thank you all so much. We ended 2017 with 457 chapters, which means we started 94 chapters last year, which is the most chapters we've ever started in a year. We ended last year with 92,194 members, which means, once again, the size of the organization doubled from 2016 to 2017. As I mentioned at the start of the call, we published 3,522 letters to the editor. The most we'd ever published before in a year was 3,000. So that was a huge jump up in letters to the editor. We published 64, you published 643 op-eds. The most we'd ever done was 547. We had 106 editorials. The most we'd ever had was 42. That one, I don't know how we're ever going to top. That one is going to seem a bit challenging for the future. We had 1,656 meetings with congressional offices. The most we'd ever had was 1,300. So you did a remarkable job in your meetings with members of Congress. We got 2,535 endorsements, which precedes all previous years combined. We added over 2,000 people to CCL who identified themselves as conservatives. We all know that's a big priority. We can't expect to bring both Republicans and Democrats along if it's just Democrats meeting with people. So adding at least 2,000 conservatives is a huge win for the organization. Also, I want to mention this. I believe that there's very strong evidence that your long-term relationship building approach is working with people. Not just that there's 66 people on the Climate Solutions Caucus, but we also try and measure the tone with Democrats and Republicans in June that we go report on in November. What we try and do is identify cynicism in Democrats. When we were lobbying in 2010 with Democrats, it was almost impossible because they were so angry and so jaded and so convinced that nothing big could ever happen again. But we only ranked seven Democrats. Of 507 meetings, we only ranked seven Democrats as seeming jaded or cynical about the possibility of making something happen. We also try and measure the engagement level of Republicans. And we only had 9 disengaged Republican offices. It completely flies in the face of the conventional wisdom of what is happening out there with Republicans in Congress. Okay, so what are we doing this month? First of all, in Canada, we're establishing our 2018 goals. We've been in a 3-month process in the U.S. of asking chapters to develop a plan so that if a bill drops, we're ready to go. I'll be updating that in just a moment now. But the Canadian chapters are also going to be doing that exercise this month, which is asking people to develop a plan for the Canadian chapters in the Canadian ridings in the event that the U.S. drops a bill. I think that's extraordinary, Canada. Thank you for that. In the U.S., we're going to develop the third part of that plan we've been working on, and this is really about member recruitment, training, and retention. There are really good tools for all 3 levels of that in your action sheet. And so this month, it's about member recruitment, retention, and training. Onboarding, rather than by retention, I meant, is onboarding them. The second thing is that we want to start off a huge blast of letters to the editor in January. I mean, 3,500 is just a crazy number from last year. And there's very good tools in the action sheet. If your newspaper gives you something that prompts you to respond to get published, there's also good tools if your paper does not give you something to respond to. And then the laser talk has to do with wildfire attribution, and it's heavily referenced. Also, if you haven't voted on the MIT contest yet, Dr. Joseph will put something in the chat so you know how to do that. You can still do that if you haven't done so. Here's the last thing I want to mention. So it will be almost 30 years to the day when we have the June conference this year that Dr. James Hansen first testified before Congress about the importance of what was happening with climate change and the need to take action. So one of the things we're going to do at the June conference is we're going to give Dr. Hansen an award to thank him for his decades of leadership and the extraordinary work. To a large degree, all of us are here because of what Dr. Hansen said to Congress 30 years ago. And I'm excited that's going to be part of this year's conference, is actually being able to thank Dr. Hansen for that. All right, I'm going to ask Ricky to unmute the lines, and everybody wants to give a shout out to Dr. Marks for thanking her for her great talk and also joining us on the 25th. Happy New Year, everybody. I think we have a nice ring for it.